listening to The RC, your guide to digital cinema, filmmaking, and cutting-edge imaging.
Hi, and welcome to this, I don't even know how to describe this, Jason, the episode after the end of the episode of The RC. In fact, it's been 9 years? It's been a while. It's been a couple of drinks.
Apologies for the gap since the last episode. You know, I had a thing. Sydney traffic.
So we are recording a special reunion episode of the RC podcast because it started out as the Red Centre podcast built around Red, and Red yesterday announced that it was all but sold to Nikon. And so for old time's sake, we thought we'd get the band back together. So how are you, Jace?
I'm excellent, thank you. We're both still alive and kicking.
Alive and kicking. So,
and it's a whole new world.
Our journey
way back then.
Yeah, our journey with Red actually started before the first camera was released at NAB when it was first announced. And we were in the queue to get, in fact, had we not stepped out of the queue momentarily to chat, we'd have had an earlier number, but we had number 22 of the original Red One. And then that led to Epic, and so it went. And yeah, so we've had a long history with Red.
And indeed, that was sort of our reconnecting in the start of this podcast, really, was you standing in that queue.
Yep. So I thought it'd be fun to get back now and look back at Red, because it becoming part of Nikon does not mean the end of Red, but clearly it's a change, a fundamental change to the company. And we thought it'd be a good time to reflect on where we thought the digital cinema camera market was at, where Red is at, and what we think the implications are of Nikon moving into the sort of high-end cinema market, which they haven't really been in. So, Jace, did the news catch you by surprise? It caught me by surprise.
It did. It did, actually, because I kind of thought we were sort of seeing a new, fresh, you know, I guess more buoyant new Red in the last year or two. They kind of turned a corner from the dark times, and it sort of felt like we were starting to see some, I don't know, a new, more approachable kind of thing. We can deep dive on all of that. But yeah, I guess I'd sort of thought that they were, you know, kind of had turned a corner, really. So it was quite interesting. Yeah, definitely took me by surprise. But I don't think, you know, the world has been flipped on its end just yet.
So what's your view of Nikon before this announcement?
Look, largely not on the radar for me, certainly not from a professional tool point of view. In the earlier days, obviously, it was never something I really adopted. They never really had anything from as a filmmaking tool. And I'm talking stepping way back to, you know, Red One days, kind of the 5D Mark II, kind of the start of that revolution, which kickstarted a lot of people's, or rebooted a lot of people's kind of careers or trajectories, I guess. So never really had much to do with them, partly also from being more old school and just physically their lenses focused the wrong direction. That was weirdly a sort of a barrier to entry somewhat. Of course, you could always have used any lens, you know, with adapters and things. But even back then, adapters were hard to do. There was no one really wanted to swap things around, you know, the lenses that fitted that camera, the ones you put on that camera, you know. Even now, we're just sort of so blessed with choices. So no, not wasn't really an option for me. When this newer, you know, a couple of interesting things, they've done a sort of a wonderful retro, I think what it is, ZF or something, which is like a wonderful old kind of Nikon retro thing purely for stills was interesting. And then, of course, the Z9 was, I think, like 18 months or a year or so ago, where they launched something that did 8K, you know, video with internal RAW. That did, you know, catch my eye, but not quite enough for me to. I've never seen one in the store or been approached by anybody with Nikon or seen, you know, it's not really been sitting on a tripod in any of the stores I go into or any of the pro resellers. So the camera might be there, but it was never really, kind of in my face enough to say, oh, that's interesting, I'll pick that up and have a play.
The last Nikon I owned was an F1 film camera that actually had, you know, 35mm film in it. And then,
The first camera I ever owned, I think, was like a Nikon Matte. You know, that was cameras, really.
And so then for a while there, it was Nikon or Canon. It was the, you know, Mac or PC. It's the, you know, Xbox or PlayStation. It was the Ford versus Falcon versus, you know,
Holden.
GM here. Yeah, Holden in Australia. I was saying that. I was thinking no one's going to get that reference in outside of Australia. Anyway, yeah, so that was the thing. And then I think what was interesting, as you said, is like we saw the Canon 5D and it just became this wonderful tool for video, even though it was kind of designed for stills, because it had interchangeable lenses, because it was recording, you know, with sort of really good characteristics. And not that long, I guess, after that, Canon actually launched that whole line of professional cinema cameras. I actually went to the launch at Paramount in LA when they had like Ron Howard there, and they just had like, I don't know, I think Scorsese was there. It was like
That was big.
That was huge. Were you there then with me that? I remember I lost my phone that day. I didn't think you
were. Yeah, no, I wasn't. I wasn't there, but it was massive. It was a massive piece of hype PR,
yeah,
which has slowly faded away.
Now, when Red came along, set the stage for us for, because it's hard to imagine now with everything that we have and the huge range of options available. But
yeah,
for me, it was 4K at 4K when no one was doing 4K, and 4K, the price 4K seemed ridiculously low. It seemed like for me to want to shoot something at that kind of resolution, I'd be $24,000, not $4,000. But if you can cast your mind back to that time, what was it?
I mean, HD was the, I mean, I'm sort of probably at that time sort of was basically, and I guess still am, aimed at whatever is the pipeline for the average television commercial or corporate thing, which is basically up until a while ago, HD was, you want to shoot HD? Wow, what are you going to do with all that extra information, let alone 4K? And 4K was more for a cinema kind of thing or effects. Back when that was launched, I guess Red One was launched, the alternative for digital cinema, very minimal. Did we even have the 5D Mark II by then? And even that, it was HD, right, wasn't it? And then we had some sort of Sony small sensors stuff that was kind of overhang from Episode One, kind of Star Wars Episode One sort of technology, really, modified video cameras. Yeah, there wasn't really a lot, and the whole 4K thing definitely wasn't a lot of that time. Again, I mean, it goes back to the whole reason we started the podcast. At that stage, that was a full-on shock to the system. Why would anyone use that? I don't know what I'm, you know, none of my editors knew what to do. Post people didn't know. No one was geared up for it. No one had the infrastructure or any knowledge of what to do on set with data or anything. It was literally a brave new world at that stage.
Actually, I'm lying slightly. The Red One was in 2007, yeah?
Right.
And 2008 was the 5D Mark II.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
But it was still shooting,
even that was
say,
very...
Like, yeah, it was shooting HD.
Both of those were bleeding edge.
Full 1920 by 1080 resolution.
Right. Spoiled.
Having said that, it was a great camera. Okay, so the Red One comes out, and I think the other thing that was really significant about the Red One wasn't just the price, wasn't just the 4K, but it had this idea that you were shooting RAW. And shooting RAW and its Red RAW code format and the way that it allowed you to actually get a signal that was designed for color grading, not designed for in some sort of QuickTime format, that was really significant. That must have made a huge difference to you.
Absolutely. I mean, at that time, literally, yes, we had, there was almost like you really had to hack the 5D Mark II to, you know, you remember little Stu's sort of quick flashcard sort of guide of how to set up the 5D Mark II to get the most gradable image, which was really just take the contrast out of it. There wasn't really any sort of log or anything going on there. And it was, there was very little controllability. The dynamic range was pretty minimal. So at that stage, before we really got the plethora of cameras we have now with fantastic dynamic range, RAW was the only way to really get a fantastic gradable image.
Yeah, the other thing was it allowed you to record back then to a CF card, which was, again, sort of mind-expanding because you were getting this 4K on something that looked like a, you know, matchbox. And on top of that, computers just weren't that fast enough to be able to deal with, you know, large data streams. And so you couldn't have got a uncompressed 4K file into a computer and done anything with it. I remember the first shoot we did with it in LA with a skateboarder was amazing. But like, you know, we had this raw file. The camera we had of the 4K was like, you know, we had tools for decoding it, but like it really heralded in post an entirely new approach to doing stuff. It was splendid in one sense because you had control. But there were weird things from the outset, but it felt like we were at the cutting edge of the revolution, right?
It was the bleeding edge of the bleeding edge, literally. Yeah. I mean, when you had the camera from memory, you didn't even have a viewfinder. You had to plug it in. It was, I think HDMI was the only thing that was working.
The first shoot we had to hold a monitor, literally hold a computer monitor, like a thing that you'd have off a PC and walk around next to it.
Yeah, there wasn't even back then, because the 5D thing propelled all of that onboard monitor thing, and HDMI and all that sort of stuff was kind of propelled that along. So yeah, there wasn't, what, you couldn't just grab a little portable HDMI monitor, really. There was absolutely nothing. The functionality was minimal. You were just the person to grab it at that time to dig through the weeds for us.
But can I also say,
show the way.
Red had very noticeable and obvious personalities and people, because I didn't know who the head of Canon was. I didn't know who the head of Arri was. I didn't know, you know, any, but I knew that there was Jim Gennard, and he was like a bigger than life figure, right? Like it was a very kind of cult of the personality, almost in a good way, right?
Yes, I think that was part of their DNA of the whole camera and how they marketed it and sold it, and you know how it was sort of, it was part of its, it took a larger than life character to do what he did at that stage, to say, you know, this is now the camera for the rest of us, and we are just going to just work our way out of this problem and find, you know, find a solution to something that no one else is really tackling. So it did,
there was
take
a sense
a big,
that you were
bold,
yeah,
big, bold,
you were taking a swipe at the kind of traditional industry, wasn't it? It was like it was an FU to like big productions or overblown expense and carry on, and that we were going to be able to, you know, storm the Bastille and get an opportunity to produce for what seemed like a ridiculously small amount of money, stuff that seemed almost imperceptible from that would be shot at the super high end.
Yes, it was, and it was, there was good and bad with that personality, and that was sort of not the beginning of the end, but it was, you know, we were in for a bit of a roller coaster, that there was no sort of free lunch there. That personality and that sort of bold sort of approach kind of was later to become, I think, what put some people off through a lot of their weird tactics. But yeah, we needed somebody up there at the beginning to kickstart that and get it rolling. But then it was definitely the perception of that camera, dealing with the people, ended up being a whole different ball game, as we both know.
Yeah, we had people like Ted, and we had you know, people like Jared, but also there was no dealer network. There wasn't like you could go to the local Red store. Like today there are Red dealers in Australia. There were no dealers, okay. Right, there was just Red in California, and it was, you had to pay homage if you wanted to get there.
You did. You had to go be ushered into the doors to go and physically pick up your order when you were deemed ready to come and pick it up, if you were deemed ready to be allowed to even order to hold
and
one.
As great as it was, because it and the Epic and stuff that followed and the Raptors and stuff that all followed, they did, you know, change the landscape. They weren't without its problems. Let's face it. If you're at the bleeding edge of stuff, things are you're gonna have problems. There was issues, and we just want to paint that was a perfect picture.
No, far from. At the very, very beginning, before it really sort of caught fire, it was yeah, and no doubt for you, quite problematic. And but that sort of felt more like a garage band kind of experiment thing. Once we started to get into the Epic thing, then they were really doing. Then they were obviously opened themselves up to the bigger they got, the more orders they got, the more they developed, the more bits and pieces they had to their machine, and the more pieces of equipment they were selling, the stickier and fiddlier and sort of darker it got.
I think the other thing that's kind of interesting is they released a bunch of cinema lenses. We don't tend to talk about the lenses as much.
Yeah, that's true.
But those lenses, which were by all rumor kind of rehoused or repackaged other lenses, were remarkably cheaper than a set of, you know, Cook or whatever.
And yeah, that's true. I guess we don't give them a bit of credit for that, do we? For doing a similar revolution.
Yeah, they did, didn't they?
Yeah, the similar revolution, I guess, glass-wise. And I guess it kind of made sense to sort of have that as part of their ecosystem. To, you know, it's great having the camera for the rest of us, but you know, everybody who actually wanted to do cinema, then well, hang on, it's great. I'm now going to rent a set of whatever Cooks or whatever Zeiss lenses that cost five times more the camera. So yeah, it was absolutely, yes, that was, and that sort of started off a lot. I mean, obviously the 5D, you know, the Canon 5D thing helped kickstart that by that stage, but most definitely it was, yeah, I guess, you know, we're not taking anywhere from the credit for kickstarting both sides of that revolution.
Yeah, I think that you could fault some of those lenses if you were comparing them to lenses that were much more expensive. But that was not the point, right? The point was you could actually have these lenses, and yeah, they were maybe not quite as good in some respects, but they were.
They were PL mount, and they were fast, and you know, had all the gearing, and they basically, you know, 75% of a cinema lens experience for 25% of the price.
Though there were a couple of hiccups along the way. Do you remember the Red mobile phone?
That was probably, yeah, yep, absolutely. I didn't buy that one. Do we know anybody who bought one of those? I wonder. Let me think. Yep. That was definitely a weird direction. And gee, that worked well. That worked
with a holographic screen.
Yep. That was, again, that was something brave, something interesting. Why not? But I saw that one coming though.
If you're going to swing for the outfield and try and hit a home run, you sometimes are going to miss, right? But, I will say this.
For me, though, I think there was a lot of, and obviously once we talk about this whole acquisition thing, I think these are some of the many things that I'll be happily, hopefully, would be part of Red's distant dark past, was there was a lot, you know, it was fairly clear that they had a bit of quite some disdain for their customers toward, you know, as things proceeded. They kind of treated them like shit on a daily basis. They were scamming their customers multiple times, really.
I don't know, scamming, that's quite a strong word.
They had overpriced and deceptively marketed media cards, which were rebadged up, and they were told, oh, this is American made and it's, you know, the highest speed, and it was rebadged up. People were cracking these things open and finding much smaller, lower grade, non-American made contents being marked up many, many times. Red Rocket cards were rebadged, lower brand cards, again, marked up extortionately. A lot of they started to build an ecosystem where you'd have the camera, every connector on it was proprietary. The way something switched on, even just run stop, was a proprietary code. You know, you had to work out, everyone had to debug how we can adapt. If you want to do a run stop, just the remote trigger on your in your hand grips, you had to buy the Red grip, or you had to buy the Red adapter if you wanted time code in and out, or SDI in and out, or, you know, the whole ecosystem was, it became this sort of shaver and blades kind of thing, where it was cheapish to buy the camera, but then all the accessories were really kind of somewhat overpriced because there was no third-party alternative because of their reliance on the whole proprietary thing. So part of them changing, turning that corner and having cameras like the Komodo and things was they went to non-proprietary. The cameras were getting more affordable and they went to non-proprietary media so you could just buy stuff off the shelf, and they slowly were moving away from, those kind of darker times, really, and were far more accessible, far more affordable. There was no real delays in buying things. You didn't have to wait and wait for your little, you know, wait for your golden Wonka ticket to come in the mail.
I actually looked up on the website, the Komodo 6K, the cheapest camera that they sell today, is US $5,995, right? Let's call it 6 grand. Yeah. I then worked out that if you allowed for inflation, the original Red One would cost you today $5,949. So, okay, it's 6K for 6K, but actually that's the same price, allowing for inflation, that the original Red One was. But, of course, they now go much, much deeper in terms of complex cameras, because at the high end, you know, you're up at, you know, 45,000 for the 8K.
Yeah.
And, of course, and it's not fair to compare the 8K with the 4K, but
No. And they just released some other newer cameras again. They're getting their higher ends getting cheaper. I think the Raptor X, you know, you're starting to get almost Vista Vision level sensors for what was, even with Red Money, was a lot more than that, even just, you know, a couple of years ago. So, you know, it's definitely, things are improving over there, but they've got a lot of bad ill will to try and recover, I guess.
So we stopped the Red Center RC podcast about the time, I think, that some of the things that you're talking about and other career changes led us to kind of go in different directions in terms of cameras and stuff. So do you own a Red today?
I do not. I had a Epic X. And then I think from then on, and that was great. That was a good experience. And I shot a lot of stuff, took that thing around the world, and it was largely bulletproof and fantastic. I think all through that, there's something, I'm going to go back to the Canon 5D, right? There's something, you can probably look back at some of your old stills, and I can look back at some of those projects I shot on that thing. And there is an inherently interesting look. I mean, partly from full frame, I was still, you know, that hooked me on the full frame look, you know, there's no going back, and I do not shoot anything other than full frame. There was something about the look of that. There was an interesting, inherently some sort of dreamy something. It wasn't just, you know, the fact that it was just HD or whatever. There's something interesting about it. And so I was always kind of hanging on to that. So I think I went from the Epic X to like Sony FS7, and now I've basically been kind of Sony. I did a Sony Sony F5, then FS7 Mark I, and then FX6 is my current camera, which I've had for 3 years, I guess. So it's been a while since I've had a Red. I have tinkered and looked at and played with Komodos and things, but nothing's quite drawn me back.
Yeah. I mean, Jason Diamond, obviously a good friend of ours, and also on the VFX show, has a bunch of Reds, and so I stay in tune with what he's doing, and he's been shooting those in a whole lot of really great setups in a whole lot of really great ways.
Absolutely, but, and they suit him down to the ground for exactly what they are doing in high resolution requirements.
Yeah. But I must admit, the stuff that I'm shooting with at the moment, well, I did two things, I guess. I was interested in virtual cinematography, so I started doing stuff that didn't need a camera, especially stuff with AI and machine learning. And then the other thing is, these days I have an R6, and yesterday I was shooting with the R5 with the Canon stereo lens, the, you know, dual input in 8K. And so I think I'm influenced in part by how fond my memories are of the Canon 5D Mark III. And so when I had an opportunity to start shooting with the new generation of the R6s and R5s, I just kind of went back there. In the middle, I went to shooting a lot of stuff on Sony. And as I say, doing a lot of stuff with virtual cinematography and virtual cameras. The other thing that I think is kind of interesting is, away from high-end productions, the quality of, since we started the RC podcast, the quality of what you can get out of an iPhone is just now jaw-dropping.
Absolutely. Absolutely. 100%. I mean, I've yet to actually use one for a job. I haven't quite been able to work that out. I mean, like the current new apps and the new Blackmagic app and the just the ability to shoot RAW and to shoot out to SSDs and shoot out to RAM. It's a great boost. And if you really were in a pinch, absolutely, you've got a lot of control with the apps and you can really dig into the weeds and dial out the phone-ness of it all, which is fantastic.
Well, I've been shooting I got a ND filter. I got a mount that I then glued to a magnetic back to my phone so it can actually clip on the phone. And then I run out from the phone to a SSD, which Velcros onto the same mount that is holding the filter. So I can actually shoot with that Blackmagic and shoot log. And it's spectacular. But the other thing that I'm doing at the moment, and why I was also shooting with that phone yesterday, is because I was shooting spatially. And so in the iPhone 15 Pro Max, I'm shooting with two lenses and capturing spatially because I have an Apple Vision Pro and I'm shooting and developing workflows for both capturing and editing spatial video. And so in addition to the Apple Vision Pro itself being a camera and it can film spatially, we were filming with the iPhone and with the Canon R5 in stereo mode. So that sort of stuff. Now, here's the thing. Jason Diamond would say, well, he shoots with his Reds in stereo with those Canon-mounted lenses on them. And it works extremely well. He's done some really high-end productions like that. But for me, I guess the thing for me is what's fundamentally changed in this configuration is how much we expect the camera to do versus how much we expect to do in post. Because any of the current digital cinema cameras, wow, marvelous, are not doing the kind of computational photography that an iPhone is. And it used to be that I was kind of quite, like, I thought that was novel, I thought that was cute. But it is ridiculous how powerful the computer is in an iPhone and then how much computational photography you can apply. I mean, there should be no way to get a shallow depth of field on an iPhone. Like, it's a pinhole camera, right? It should be infinite depth of field. Like, it shouldn't in any way look like a shot that I might have shot with a large format sensor. And yet, for many people, it is. And I'm not saying that it would replace your workflow, but for a lot of people, they are getting really good images. Add to that, as I say, that you can now grade it so much more effectively.
There will definitely be a crossover further down where, that computational is going to get better and better. And
well, the reason I bring this up is do you think Nikon would take that approach and start? Because I was stunned that Canon didn't. I thought, why didn't Canon make a computational photography SLR effectively, right?
Yeah. Well, maybe they're all, I'm confused why what happened to Canon at all and to Panasonic, actually. If you look at, I'm now just talking about the high end of town, all of that Hollywood fanfare about the C500 Mark II and the C700, nothing. It hasn't been, it was 4 years ago plus that they launched the C500 Mark II and C300 Mark III or whatever it is. Nothing. They basically almost essentially abandoned that end of their market. Panasonic themselves have said, we're not doing any. The Vericam, that's all. Basically, I think they've announced that they're basically stopping any sort of development, and that's basically end of life, that end of the market for them. So, I mean, what obviously there's a bit of writing, definitely some writing on the wall for the average happy, snappy film camera, or you know what I mean, for just a DSLR mirrorless thing. We are definitely in, you know, a couple of, we've seen how exponentially incredibly how quickly AI has just computational photography has just the portrait mode on the iPhone now is just getting so much better. I don't bother taking a camera out for recces anymore. And just portrait mode even alone is just incredible. And we're only a couple of years away from just getting really good emulation of all lenses on all for in all focal lengths. You know, obviously it's still limited at the moment, but yeah, I think that's definitely the mid range of cameras that's probably, you know, slowly dying. So I'm just wondering why these camera companies abandoned the high end, and they obviously have completely dropped the ball on that. You've got basically Canon's relying on things like the R6, which is fantastic. All of that sort of stuff is really, really good and worthy. Everyone loves those, and very, very worthy descendant of 5D Mark II, etc.
I don't know where
my ramblings are going with this. It's such
But it is. It is. Well, I find it interesting, and heck, that was always our yardstick for the show, right?
Of course.
But I picked up by just pure chance a Canon 5D Mark III the other day because I had one and never felt like I wanted to sell it, and somebody wanted to use a camera, and I was like, well, if you use this and you trash it, I don't care because I haven't really used it. But picking it up and handing it to him, I'm like, this is quite a lot bigger than an R5 or an R6.
Yeah,
and even the whole problem of just carrying an R6 around with you, like, and lenses, right? That's like a lot of weight. Yeah. And I don't know if you've seen what Fujifilm have done, not at the high end, but like, have you seen their X100 6, V6, whatever it is?
Yeah, V2 or whatever it is, V1, whatever we call it. I owned the original X100, and of course, just being, you know, full frame. But I could never really loved it. I love the design. I love their menus. I love the film emulation side of things. It's fantastic. They get a lot right. For me, it's just slightly small. I just can't wait for Fuji to do that kind of thing and give us exactly what they're copying, which is, you know, a range finding full frame camera, where a lot of those ones, like, they've got a fixed lens of, I don't know, whatever it is, 28, something like that, 25, 24. And for me, I just, the fact that I could never really get much out of focus because it's, you know, it's 2.8 or something like that lens, wide-ish lens, slightly slow, smaller sensor. For me, it never really added up to giving me much shallower depth. Obviously, that's not the be-all and end-all of a lovely photograph. But for me, I never quite gelled with that original version. And obviously, the 100V. Set the world alight mystically. And this one next version of it.
They're really expensive in the second-hand market. Like, actually finding
the 100 has got this cult status, which I still can't quite understand, because I think a lot of it is the film emulation and how easily it will spit you out obviously it'll shoot raw, but how easily should it spit out a usable, nice-looking, interesting, engaging JPEG too, with all the with all the filters attached. That back end of those cameras are incredible. They just change the front end a little bit, you know, a full frame. Come on, guys.
We picked one up on the back streets of in Japan, in you know, like one of those camera stores that are like four stories high, kind of thing.
Yeah, big camera.
But yeah, they're like on the net. They're just people are paying over the asking price for them. It's insane.
Yeah.
But I guess that shows you that people want to do interesting photography. People want to do interesting stuff. It feels to me like the next frontier is some camera that could be a red Nikon hybrid, or could be if Canon woke up and discovered computational photography. That is like all of that stuff we got in the iPhone, but happening in a camera with an interchangeable lens, which would be phenomenal what you could pull off. Having said that, the iPhone manages to do that because they sell so many darn bloody iPhones that you have vast engineering and manufacturing muscle to get the price down.
Yeah, and obviously it's a super whatever hyper computer, whatever you want to call it, with a lens attached. It is doing incredible things, literally, while, you know, in live view, and we've got a super computer in your hand.
And I think it's not just these sort of optical characteristics. I mean, I had one of those things you clip a phone into, which was the, you know, because we always had this whole thing about stabilizers and gyros and stuff.
And stabilized
gyro on an iPhone is redundant these days because the options for doing that in the camera are so bloody good that I can't really pick it.
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing a lot of sort of gimbally, steady cammy kind of related jobs, and just for recce, just wandering around, just previewing things. I had exactly that thing, like the little DJI little iPhone gimbal, and halfway through, I just gave up and just before I couldn't remember getting in my bag because I just nowadays stabilizing on the wider lenses on the wide end of the iPhone is incredible.
So Nikon has taken on Red, and it's a really interesting play for them to getting into the cinema market. I mean, they're not that they've had no presence, but they really haven't had a major presence. For me, though, it only makes sense if they can do something with it other than just, I mean, I don't think that I'm correct in saying this. I think that they probably will just run Red exactly like it is right now. But I think it only makes sense if they were to do something that Red couldn't do on its own. And and let's not forget, and I looked it up actually, Nikon is like, I mean, they're getting 200 employees from Red that are folding into the company, and they have 18,500 or 18,700.
Yeah, they've got like 100 times the personnel,
Yeah, so... So they could do something really interesting. Now, we should also point out that Nikon spends a lot of its time with those employees not doing cameras. They do microscopes, they do rangefinders, they do all sorts of industrial stuff. Well, yeah. But they do have incredibly good R&D, incredibly good optics. And if I was, and God forbid, if I was in that loop, I'd be saying, the thing we need to bring into this is the power of what's going on with machine learning and stuff, because that to me is the only way you could then hope to differentiate and move beyond. I guess what would you need to see to consider like a next generation? I'm not talking like 5 or 10 years. I mean, like if something was coming out in like 2 or 3 years, what would be the sort of the ideal camera that would spark your interest that might get you to move back?
That you think Red would make?
Well, a Red Nikon could make. I'm not saying they will make. I'm just saying, like, what would be the... Forget the reality of the world. If a year from now they announced that something was coming out in a year that had X, what would it be?
Look, I mean, I mean, part of the reason for sort of, I guess, Red, the RC, the podcast kind of winding up, I suppose, was the fact that even then we were almost at peak camera. You know, almost every single camera release was, everything was amazing. Everything's fantastic and no one's happy. But it was, I think we're so close now. I mean, I just had a last couple of days playing with the DJI, the Ronin 4D, which I thought, wow, this is going to be my every camera. It's definitely not. If you're familiar with it, it's essentially DJI saying, well, what if we combined a camera with a gimbal and gave you full frame and gave you full control and it could transmit by itself? And it's an incredibly interesting package. And that's an interesting recipe. I don't know what my ideal camera is, because currently I'm still kind of have every job I need almost something different. Sometimes I need gimbals. Sometimes I just run and gun. But at the moment,
you are talking about the chicken neck camera, right?
Exactly. 4D being the fourth axis, being the up and down, basically taking out of your, helping you with the ninja walk, I guess. So it's basically like, what if you took a camera and love child of a gimbal and a regular digital cinema camera with almost no compromises. It is big and heavy, and the ergonomics of it are unusual, but It's an interesting direction to take. I can't be my all-in-one camera. There is no all-in-one camera. So I don't know what the ideal camera would be. For me, it's full frame. I don't need much more than, for the moment, 4K is perfectly fine for average broadcasting. It's good to shoot 4K for repositioning and blowing up and things, and most projects are still going out as finalizing, being finished in HD. So you just want to be, so we don't need massive resolution. The maybe a little tiny bit more dynamic range would be great, but
yeah, I was gonna say dynamic range
on the whole, dynamic range is still dynamic range on even just the FX6 is fantastic. Most things have great, you know, dynamic range. We're not really needing a ton more detail, which is why something like RAW isn't necessarily anymore this thing to reach for. So few projects really shoot RAW these days. Most features, most of that stuff, just generally most jobs that where an Alexa or whatever is going off the shelf out the door is to just shoot with internal ProRes. There's only even like a lot of VFX projects, or you shooting building a camera array, all of that stuff isn't necessarily going out RAW either. The cameras are so good with what they can do just in log and their resolution and their dynamic range, that RAW is a sort of more high-end, really very specific set of requirements. And it's very few films where the producers say, we must shoot RAW.
That that Ronin 4D, our friend Ed Moore shot Hijack, or at least part of Hijack with that, when he was in the plane.
He did shoot part of that on there, yeah, indeed.
Because he could get in and round and have it stabilized. But it is... It in the history of cameras, I think it's going to be an asterisk as a really interesting. I can't see all cameras going that way, I guess is what I'm saying.
No, but what is interesting is they've created an interesting sort of world where everything interplays. Their monitors are everything's two way. The transmitters and receivers and the monitors. I can tap on my director's monitor and control ISO and shutter and all this, and roll. I can hit roll. I can use it in gyroscope mode where I literally can move the monitor around in my hand and you know, control pan and tilt. And the person carrying the camera can literally just be a grip, just walking from between marks, you know, and I can just be entirely control of the camera, and they can just carry it, just be a two-legged dolly, really. And it's an interesting sort of ecosystem, really, that I quite like. And maybe the Mark II version of that might be almost getting perfect, but there's a lot of interest there in something that it can be run and gun, and then can literally replace a dolly or replace a full gimbal and shoots 6K or 8K in full frame with internal indeed. Incredible. And shoot RAW or shoot very, very high end.
So moving away from that, back to what you're shooting with now, what lenses are you liking at the moment?
I'm still using my old modified old Contax pre-Berlin Wall fall Contax. I guess they're just fast old German, I guess basically the internals of what would have been a set of Zeiss Super Speeds, and all modified with to be anamorphic with the classic internal ovals that I had fitted all into the optical axis of the lens, basically. And for me, that has been fantastic. It's been a nice, subtle anamorphic look without having to deal with all the issues that come with anamorphics, you know, and being stuck with the stretch ratio, but with some nice flares and not too contrasty and sharp enough just a nice, subtle look that everybody loves. So the combination of the FX6 those lenses. And yeah, it's a nice recipe for now until the next thing comes along.
What's your post pipeline now?
My post pipeline is give it to someone else and I'll see you in online. I don't know. I don't really handle any of the post anymore, but a lot of the times I'm going to places now, the real high end of town where we probably first met Mike in a full on online suite is now a very much of a hybrid affair where they have a computer that can swap from being a a resolve station to cutting on Avid or cutting on Premiere cutting in Resolve and grading in Resolve. Basically that's the sort of the newer post models is more flexible, more mobile, more nimble post houses that have three or four rooms that can be adapted to be anything. You want to grade in that room, great. And then you want to cut in that room and you want to Avid, sure, no worries. We'll fit the Avid to that one and that room can now be a grading room. And so they no longer can they just have like dedicated rooms that just do one thing, because you've got freelance editors all have their own sort of editing preference. And you want to just literally just tweak something, or you just go back into a grade, or just while you're in the middle of in an online session, you can flip to grade to tweak something, and then you can just do a little bit of online fix or blur something or patch something out in Resolve, or go back to editing and tweak Premiere. So basically, most of the time, yes, my post is being done with external houses, and there are the more mobile, nimble, adaptable hybrid post places, I guess, these days.
I resisted the move from Premiere to Resolve for editing for the longest time, just because I was like, but I know how to be really fast in Premiere. And they were like, but yeah, it's really good in Resolve. And I was like, yes, but I'd be slow in Resolve and I have to get something done today. And then I was won over by a bunch of tools, again, mainly machine learning AI tools, everything right just down to cleaning up audio stuff that I could do in a third-party app, but was just working perfectly inside Resolve, and stereo workflows and a bunch of other stuff. So
yeah,
I have to say, you're the first person that said that they edit on Avid to me in a long while.
I obviously personally don't know how to, I've never really adapted. Yes, sure. I who use Avid editors. Yes.
Yeah.
But it's a real mix. I'd say it's probably a third of the editors I would use would be on Avid, a third would be more Premiere based, and the other third would be slowly migrating to Resolve. But I think a lot of the reason for hanging on to the Premiere thing is because they can just quickly pop into After Effects and do a little tweak, because they're constantly being asked to, even though you're an editor, can you just knock up this, what would have been 5 years ago, incredibly ridiculously complicated graphics animation thing to do, and expected to knock it out in half an hour and send it to us. So, there's definitely Avid editors out there. They're more higher end ones, which are dedicated to just doing a cut. And please don't ask me to do anything more complicated outside of that, because I won't do it and you won't ask me, because I'm at that level, I guess. It's definitely a more higher end, I guess, sort of mindset. Slightly older school, I suppose.
Are you delivering in a high dynamic range? Like, are you looking at stuff?
No.
If
you remember all of those NABs we went to, and when HDR came out, I thought, wow, this is going to be the next. This is the end of the pixel wars. We're going to go, this is the new thing. Look at this. Look at what this can do. And I don't think that somehow gained traction. I don't think anyone ever mentioned it again. And I never really was prompted or prodded to even bother raising the question with anybody about it. Somehow, I don't know, I thought that was really going to be the next big thing. You know, we saw some monitors there in NAB and we thought, wow, this HDR thing is just incredible. But I don't
it's
think
funny you should say that, because
I don't think that pipeline actually, has ever really
well, no, I think
propagated.
You're wrong. I think you're completely wrong. I'll tell you why I think you're wrong. It's because I'm sitting in front of a high-end Apple monitor, and those high Apple monitors have really high nits. And if I watch stuff that I've shot on the iPhone with a HDR on my computer screen in front of me, it looks sensational. If I try taking that to my telly that doesn't play, like plays more standard, it doesn't look that good. It just now. I agree with you that in your market, that's not the case. But there are a bunch of people, I think, that increasingly consume their media on computer screens. And if you're looking on a high-end Apple laptop or high-end professional Apple screen, it looks really good because it has the nits, it has the dynamic range, it has the blacks to be able to give you something that looks amazing. And then you have to kind of total that down to just put it on you know, as a quick time that you'll give to somebody on a normal whatever. I don't know.
I agree. Like, where people are watching this stuff. No doubt looks great, but there's never really been, shown us the way of how to do that. I think everyone's kind of still stuck in the past there in terms of that.
Even taking migration. An iPhone footage into Resolve can be a delicate exercise in knowing which buttons and menus to press to make sure that that actually comes out faithfully.
But I mean, almost every TV you would buy now would be HDR, to some degree HDR capable. I don't know. I think it's been a really slow, it's non-existent adoption of
to
that.
To Red then. So what's the path forward for a successful Nikon Red? If it isn't HDR and if it isn't 8K and it isn't RAW, then what exactly... I mean, there are obviously applications for all of those things. I mean, I guess you could argue
absolutely.
At the high end, we've seen Oppenheimer do spectacular business because it could show stuff in IMAX. Mm. But the IMAX cinema camera market has got to be about the smallest niche market for actual cameras, right? I mean...
Yeah, as they slowly keep smashing cameras up and destroying them or, you know, having to slowly rebuild them, yes, I think there'll be... It's a very niche... niche end of town. I think I don't know. It's. I've been thinking about this last. You know, obviously, just for a day since this announcement came. It's. I'm not sure. I don't know what got Red to where it is. So I don't know what improved it. I thought that, like I said, I thought they'd kind of turned this corner and everything. I mean, I don't know what was the motivation for them to sell. I can only presume they've been chopping it around for a little while, and maybe the Nikon lawsuit was a kind of a catalyst or potential. I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm really not sure what was the trigger that started it all. So I don't know how they got to where they are. But I mean, I think for me they're not far off. I mean, I think this would be a great, the interesting merger from what it does for Red, maybe, than what it does for Nikon. I'd like to see, again, it's the RAW thing is, you know, take it as it comes. But I guess they would, for a start to license out or release the thumb cuffs off the patent. So more cameras can record internal RAW. Obviously, some people skirt it with doing sort of it was mainly the non-debayed RAW, I think, wasn't it? That was the crux of the patent and why some other people can still do RAW because it was debayed or something. But I think the industry will be better off if they can at least have a bit more access to license that, and we're going to see less docking recorders on the back of things, and less, you know, obviously for the last 5, whatever, 10 years, most camera companies have had to do complicated and expensive workarounds, and that would be great to be able to release that a little bit. But I think maybe, yeah, the Red will be a more approachable one, maybe more technically. A lot of the technical prowess from Nikon will flow into Red, and we'll see better images. Less, I mean, a lot of stuff like the Komodo was fantastic, very small little compact thing which nearly had me, but with everything, I like a little bit of what Canon always did, where there was like 90% perfection, and there was always this 10% really weird gotcha. Like you could shoot a 200 frames a second or something, but you had to do it in black and white, or you know, had to shoot upside down or something like that. There was always something ridiculous. You had to shoot in zero gravity. There was some weird thing about it. There was always a gotcha, and the Komodo and stuff like that would be great. But if you wanted to shoot 50 frames, it would have an incredible crop on it. But it had fantastic, you know, it could do global shutter. So it had some fantastic, there was really great positives, but then there was always a little bit of a negative. There was always some reason that sort of held me back. But I think maybe, with the Nikon, with their incredible prowess with technology and what they've done with Z9 and stuff like that, maybe that'll filter across, and the next gen, the next versions of cameras from them will be maybe more affordable, more little less hobbled by some weird kind of gotchas, and maybe just a more approachable company. The patents will be more easily distributed, not for free, obviously, but more easily licensed. I can't see Nikon building a RED. I can't, because I mean, I like what we've seen with Canon and with Panasonic basically dropping that high end of the stuff, not really even developing it anymore. I can't see Nikon doing, maybe they could. That would be an incredible love child up that high end of the business. I'd love to see what they can come up with based on what the new Nikon has done with Z9. I think it's maybe more flow the other way and how RED will improve rather than how Nikon will necessarily improve.
Yeah, I must say there's some great stuff that I love that's been shot on the RED, my favorite being Foundation, that series I just adore. So, I think I want RED to go well. I want them to do stuff. I think the world's a better place for them being in it and doing stuff, absolutely.
Do we know who's like staying? I mean, is Jared still staying there? I mean, do we know what's happening personnel-wise? Obviously, we don't know what's happening at the sort of from more sort of managerial on CEO side of things.
Yeah, no, I don't know that. I do know that it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out because, you know, apart from anything else, I'm pretty sure you can't buy a RED lens anymore. Maybe that'll change very quickly.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see what happens there, obviously, because I'm sure they won't stop using the RF mount, but maybe they'll probably let you have the Canon Z mount as an option. I think the lens mounting sort of side of things has never been too much of an issue. There's always been a little bit of third-party stuff. They allowed stuff like, a lot of people to build external mounts. If you remember back in the day, even with the Epic, you had to get their own. You had to buy the titanium $2,000 PL or EF, active EF mounts. And now, of course, many people are making the mounts. Or now that they've gone to a non-proprietary mount system, you can go from RF to many adapters, and that's been RED has been able to get some fantastic sales, I think, out of the fact that they've gone with a lens mount that's adaptable. It's basically the equivalent of E-mount now. There's probably not a mount in the world that you can't adapt from E-mount to something else and do it well, or do it very robustly and professionally.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Jace, it's been wonderful catching up with you and, of course, discussing not just RED, but kind of the world in which RED is joining with Nikon, that complex world. I have missed our chats, though it's been a while between drinks.
Well, I'll catch you in another 9 years, I guess.
Guys, thanks so much for listening. If you want to follow up with anything or send us anything, we'd always appreciate you sending us an email on doing stuff. Jason, if people want to contact you and quiz you on things or applaud your...
Sure. My website at wingrove.film, or I used to plug, back in the old days, to say, you can get me on Twitter, but I think we're done with that. Twitter and X, forget it. Jace Wingrove on Instagram, or wingrove.film for my website.
Thank you guys so much for this reunion episode of the RC podcast.
An incredible experience. I miss it.
Can I just say, it's been recent. Thank you, my friend. See ya.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. Send your questions or comments to rc@fxguide.com. Copyright 2011, FX Guide LLC.